So, four and one are in order. Can we have a roll call?
Smith.
Here.
Moore.
Here.
Cable.
Here.
Scarlett.
Here.
And we have a forum. Are there any proposed changes to the agenda? Are there any proposed changes to the meeting minutes from the meeting on January 2nd? Any proposed changes? Let's stop the meeting for these minutes. Now it's time to.
We just have like an eye vote or something, just for the record, or a roll call, whatever.
Do we need a voice vote for that?
Yeah, please.
Okay, do we have a voice vote to confirm the minutes from January 2nd? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Now it's time for public comment. The members of the public present. Are there any additional items that are proposed to add to the agenda that are not already on the agenda? All right. So, item 6.1, discussion of site erosion and sediment control and post-construction stormwater management draft permits. Yeah.
Okay. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. So you've seen this before a couple times. A lot has changed, so I'm going to go through it.
There's a lot of red in there.
It's all red. I've also included on the podium there next to you the current ordinance, because my PowerPoint is just existing. So just real quick, the current ordinance has two things in it. It says, on that second page under the table, to use best management practices for stormwater control. That's the extent of our stormwater control requirements. On the first page, it includes spacing requirements for perimeter control, for erosion control, and that's what that table is. And that's taken directly from the statewide urban design guidelines. So, that's what we're working with currently. And now I'll start with what we're doing tonight. So we're just going to go through it. Just stop me with any questions or comments about. And then we're not taking action tonight. We just wanted to go through a draft review before we were out of stakeholders again, and meet with stakeholders to get comments, and before we were out of county departments again for final comments. Bring it back for one more time where we will take action. Fingers crossed. Okay. So, there is a statement of intent now for sedimentation and erosion. It talks about how sedimentation and erosion pollutes water, degrades land, development activities cause land to become susceptible to this erosion and sedimentation, and how we've adopted these requirements to protect public and private property and natural resources to preserve their function. We still state that any development over an acre has to obtain a national pollutant discharge elimination system permit. That is required by the state, and it's already in our code. But we've included they shall submit the plans and specifications supporting their application to the DNR of that NPDES permit and their authorizations from the DNR to us as well, because we have had some issues with compliance with those permits. And then any other development that is not required to obtain an NPDES permit shall submit a sediment and erosion control plan to us, in addition to their development permit applications, or if they're not applying for a zoning permit or a subdivision, their grading permit. So that's the new thing, we have that grading permit. I think there was discussion before about being duplicative of the NPDES permit requirements, so now, if you get an NPDES permit, you submit that. If you don't, you can submit to us another plan. And our hope is that you'll find the the requirements for the plan are easy to understand and implement on site, just for anyone. So that's our goal. So when someone submits a plan, it should contain, the best management practices for erosion and sediment control that they've selected for their site, a narrative, their construction schedule and grading schedule, a site plan, and a maintenance procedure for each one.
On that prior slide, there was any development that disturbs one or more acres. Where did we get that number?
That's from the state code. It's within the existing ordinance.
Okay.
Yeah. So real quick, some definitions I've integrated throughout when going through the definition section. Best management practices of sediment control means best management practices that are designed to capture soil particles after they have been flushed. Best management practices of erosion control, on the other hand, are best management practices that are designed to prevent that dislodging of soil particles in the first place. So there's several just basic practices that you can implement when you're doing work on your property to prevent erosion and sedimentation. So those include limiting exposed area, not grading the whole site, or maybe staging grading in different on different schedules, limiting exposure time, so stabilizing, temporarily stabilizing your site after you're done, and this is more for stormwater, minimizing soil compaction, restoring soil quality, restoring topsoil. Now we have standards for protecting neighboring properties and water courses, which kind of gets into the perimeter control that we had before. So when you have a slope on your property, you install perimeter controls or potentially upgrade controls so that that erosion doesn't impact folks next door, right of way, water. Divert runoff when you have an area that has been disturbed. And now we have proposed standards for concrete waste management, so for cleaning out concrete trucks after they pour, and also standards for final site stabilization. So when we go out to a site and issue a final permit, we can say, no, you have to have this density of seeding, which needs to be. So under each of these categories, we have a few criteria. It's kind of like suggestions. If this applies to your site, you should implement this practice. So, for instance, the smallest practical area of land should be exposed at any given time. Natural plant coverage shall be retained. You should mark areas on site that are not supposed to be disturbed so that no one parks their dozer on top of that site. And you should mark the areas to be developed, again, for the same reason. Limiting exposure time. The amount of area disturbed at once should be limited through staging. All areas, including stockpiles, should have a temporary erosion control stabilization, maybe temporary feeding, hay, mulch, within 14 days after no longer being actively worked. So if you're not using that top soil stockpile for 2 weeks, you should put some sort of temporary erosion control on it. We got that from the state NPDES permit, actually, at the time. And then you should also consider seasonal limitations. So if you're going to be grading in winter, think about maybe putting down as your stabilization measure for when it thaws and you get a spring storm event that can create more erosion than would normally happen. Criteria for minimizing soil compaction. Again, these are pretty simple things that you could do. So just reduce passes over an area with heavy equipment. Again, confine areas, mark areas that construction activities can or cannot occur on, and don't use heavy equipment on wet soil. Don't remove topsoil unless required, and if you're are going to be using it for restoration after development, keep it on site. And then when you're restoring topsoil, you should follow the methods for soil quality management and restoration in the Iowa Stormwater Management Manual. And there's a chapter on how to till and create a mix of compost and topsoil to create a healthy soil profile in that chapter. Protecting neighboring properties. Criteria includes constructing a construction entrance before land disturbing activity. So this isn't something we see all the time. A lot of times, you know, the pump truck comes in and there's construction entrance and it's stabilized yet, and it's just dirt that they're pulling into and it gets trashed onto the road. Implementing perimeter control measures, so kind of like our ordinance outlines right now, you know, for filter socks on borders prior to disturbing activity. When there's a slope to site borders, one of the comments we got is, well, what if I have 100-foot of flat grass in between me and my neighbor's property? Do I need perimeter controls at that point? We kind of specify, you know, if there's a slope or potential for runoff to impact the neighbor's property. And we did also note that if you need to get into a site, you can move the perimeter controls to allow passage of vehicles. So that was another comment we got, that folks just run over and they're not affected anymore. Protecting water courses. When you have exposed soil areas that slope to a water course, you should have temporary erosion control stabilization suspended after you're no longer actively working that area. And just a general statement about discouraging development in the floodplain. Also, we have our buffer zone requirement in this section, where if you're working near a water course, there's a required distance from that water course. These recommended buffers are from our watershed assessment that the county has completed. They have a map that actually shows different features and have suggested for our priority streams, for instance, a 75-foot buffer. So that's where these numbers came from. And we also direct people, as you can see in this paragraph, to look at that map and see what features might be on their property. We also say that perimeter controls shall be installed prior to work on or near stream banks or lake shores. This diverting runoff criteria may be one of the criteria that you might need a professional to install. For sites where flow occurs over a disturbed area, a temporary flow diversion measure, such as an earthen diversion structure, pipe slope, filter berm, shall be constructed prior to the land disturbing activity. So a lot of the times, those have to be sized to take a certain volume of water, so you have to know how much water is draining to the site. That's why you might need a professional for this one. You should stabilize those diverting members if they involve exposed soil. Runoff should be discharged to a stable outlet as well if you're using those measures. So that could be using ground outlet protection. And then also disturbed slope lengths shall be broken up. So if you have, you know, a hillside that's been disturbed, you can use, for instance, a silt fence to break up those slopes. Several smaller slopes so that you don't allow a sheet flow to become more concentrated. You can kind of break it up again to prevent that concentrated flow where runoff gaining velocity and doing more damage, creating more erosion on that hillside. And then concrete waste management is our seventh criteria. You know, containing concrete waste in washout areas is required. Matching and traveling your saw cut slurry, and then removing and cleaning your washout area within 14 days. And then finally, our final site stabilization is the last criteria. And so within 7 days of achieving your final grade, you should stabilize soils with a vegetative cover of a uniform density of at least 70%. And that is from our Iowa urban design guideline or design criteria that's from a manual. And I also believe in the NPDES requirement. But you can also use temporary control if you can't establish permanent control or permanent cover at that point. Any questions on the criteria?
Can you talk about what is recommended and what is
sure. So, most the language I'll hear is shall, but I think it depends on when one of these criteria is applicable to your study.
Well, like you were talking about before, that was derived from the watershed assessment, I believe it's a recommendation.
Well, you can have a minimum. You can have a greater buffer. So, the watershed
land disturbance?
It's,
from either?
You shouldn't disturb within a certain number of feet of a given water course, and the watershed assessment recommended these. And so we're saying if you're disturbing a site that has a water course or one of these features on it, you shall have a buffer set of it. There is a provision to request the encroachment if needed.
Their
minimum.
Doesn't the DNR already have all of this at the state level?
They have an NPDES permit for erosion control for sites over an acre.
So does the county need to adopt something when the DNR state already has it, they have a course of it? This would be less than a 1 acre, probably where there's impact to the soil. That's not covered under DNR?
No. So we've had some issues where, you know, somebody's just building one house, they grade their entire property. They grade their entire lot. And that creates a lot of issues right of way, neighbors, and they're not covered by that state permit.
Right. And to your aid, we go out and the sites where they're larger than an acre, where we have a state permit, we want to be able to communicate with the DNR that both of us are able to see that sometimes they're not meeting.
They're not compliant.
There might not be any erosion control.
So if the site's over an acre that have NPDES, you can help enforce someone. How is that working?
Yeah, we're talking about communication. We're not talking about enforcing.
Okay.
I think the hope, though, is that we'll be able to take some training on erosion control once we have this, on actually implementing these and what to look for as an inspector on site. On sites where we are the ones overseeing the erosion and sediment control plan, we know what to look for, and we know what their plans actually contain and require as well. So we can say, hey, you know, you submitted your stormwater plan and you submitted to the DNR to us, and it looks like you're supposed to have perimeter controls in your work. Or we can even, if we had the appropriate training, say they weren't installed correctly.
Do you get complaints from neighbors that have kind of getting involved in this?
Occasionally, and sometimes they come up with subdivisions that are doing, you know, reviews on them where they may have a permit in place and there's no erosion control materials in certain areas of the development. So we want to be able to, like you said, recognize where they were according to the plan where they were being installed and maybe what those installation practices are. And really, it's just a way for us to identify and then communicate. Because again, if the state permits, so the state should follow up in communication with the property owner. But primarily, these provisions are for improvements that occur, disturbances, the properties under the engineer.
So I think moving on from the criteria, if there are any more questions, is the protection of non-exemptions and inspections and responsibility are large to the state for previous ordinances. So we still have in our statement that we're not liable for any damages resulting from erosion and sedimentation on both properties. Our acceptance of their plan doesn't mean we approve their design or construction method. That we will inspect their practices as part of their preliminary zoning permit before they pour foundation. We check their erosion control practices at that point. They're on the site. that they control shouldn't be removed until there's been final stabilization. We reject the final stabilization through final inspection. And that if you have any amendments or changes to your plan, that you should communicate with those with us. And then we have an agricultural exemption. This is from the state code of Iowa, exempting agricultural activities from zoning. And then we have an exemption for the county engineer because they do a lot of right-of-way maintenance and don't want to submit a plan up every time that we have to fix the tile in a right-of-way. So that's erosion control. Can you move into stormwater? Yeah? Ever? Okay. So for stormwater, again, we have a statement of intent that stormwater increases pollution, flooding, stream temperatures, and erosion. The following requirements apply to development in Story County to minimize the generation of stormwater, maximize pervious areas, provide a consistent set of performance goals for stormwater, so moving away from just saying in the current ordinance, use best management practices and moving toward a numeric criteria that everybody can follow, which is important. Protecting our natural resources and protecting life and property from flooding and maintaining existing flow patterns and protecting groundwater. So, development of the following threshold shall submit a stormwater management plan. Development or cumulative development, so that could be development with on adjacent sites or part of a common development plan or development in stages. That's 1 acre or greater in size. So that could be the development or the disturbance area, 1 acre or greater in size. And then any division of land involving a major subdivision plat, what we kind of foresaw with this second threshold is that when you're doing a subdivision, you might not know how much land you're going to disturb right off the bat. But with major subdivisions, those involve over 4 lots and a road, typically. So you're likely going to get to that 1 acre disturbed threshold anyway with a major subdivision plan. The criteria of the plan, all developments shall be designed, constructed, and maintained to prevent flooding, minimize stream channel impacts, protect water quality, and achieve the purposes of this ordinance as stated above. And all developments requiring a stormwater management plan shall implement a set of practices known as low-impact development. So that would include preserving natural areas, protecting open spaces, reducing impervious cover, and distributing runoff, and using pervious areas in the site's natural topography to treat stormwater runoff. This is a new statement in this chapter related to using and taking advantage of a site's natural hydrology and ability to treat stormwater without needing to use expensive or large structural controls. And then we also have a statement that whenever possible, you should use conveyance facilities open to the atmosphere instead of enclosed pipes. So, for instance, vegetative buffers instead of enclosed pipes to transport or convey runoff. Because that'll help with, getting sediment out of stormwater runoff, removing pollutants, infiltration. And then we get into our numeric criteria. So, all development requires to submit a stormwater management plan that disturbs an area of 1 to 5 acres shall be designed to manage a water quality volume of a rainfall depth of 1.25 inches through infiltration-based best management practices and low-impact development, and protect streams designed to provide 24 hours of extended detention of what we call the channel protection volume. And that's for the 1 year 24-hour storm. So why do we have these requirements? For the first one, the water quality volume, 90% of the rainfall events in Iowa are 1.25 inches or less. So by managing these storms, having a criteria to manage the volume created by these storms, the majority of the water volume will be treated. And many of those first flush pollutants will also be effectively managed on site since they won't enter. Regarding the second criteria, This is about protecting stream channels from erosion and erosion velocities. So typically the 1 year to 2 year storm is what creates a bank full flow in a stream. So by requiring management of the 1 year storm, we're preventing habitat degradation and erosion related to enlarging a stream or creating fissures in a stream when you have those bank full flows. Development requires to submit a stormwater management plan that develops an area over 5 acres, has to meet these additional criteria, and those are the peak discharge rate from all storms up to the 100-year 24-hour event shall not be greater than the pre-settlement discharge rate. So that's different than controlling the volume. I put a hydrograph on here because I thought it was the best way to illustrate what this is getting at. So you can see the tallest curve here. This is post-development with no control. So underneath the curve is the volume. And you can see the volume over time. So the horizontal axis is time. So when you have no runoff control, post-development versus this pre-development curve, you can see that the peak discharge of runoff is much higher. The volume is much higher. It sticks to that volume much faster. Whereas this third curve is using our practice to control the peak discharge. So you see this dotted line. This is the pre-development peak discharge level. You're maintaining that level. The volume might be greater, but it's held over time. It might be for detention practice or other practice that we're not creating this critical volume that can lead to flooding or stream erosion. And so the requirement again is that peak discharge from the pre-settlement rate is matched by the post-development discharge rate. And so what that means is you're basically matching the post-development rate to what would be a meadow in good condition. So prairie for Iowa. Previously, we had the pre-development condition as its requirement, and it was really hard to establish a baseline of what that was. And so while this is a more conservative criteria designed to, we've introduced some credits in the end of the chapter to bring those numbers closer together if you do practices such as preserve natural area on your site to make that a little bit easier to design for. So these are the contents of the stormwater management plan. Different from erosion control, this plan shall be prepared by a licensed engineer or landscape architect. You should include in your plan any features on your site that may impact the design or requirements. So building footprints, division lines, soil conditions, easements and right-of-way, site topography, the drainage boundary of the proposed development, and existing drainage patterns, any off-site drainage area that contributes, any water courses or other natural areas, and drinking water wells and septic systems when you're doing infiltration practices and supporting the water zone. You should also identify the proposed best management practices, including their location, landscaping, sizing, their runoff value that they'll capture, and any maintenance procedures. So the inspections and responsibility section basically the same as erosion control, except we have an exception for stormwater for maintenance of development has occurred prior to the adoption of this ordinance that doesn't count towards the LIHTC requirements if you did it in compliance with our ordinance. Because that's an issue we've heard a lot about, is when folks put a resurfacing the parking lot that's already been paved, putting in an underground detention system, it's really cost prohibitive and an issue. So we included that. And then we also included some exceptions for when you have physical characteristics of your site that can't do some of these practices. So, for instance, when you're looking at the water quality volume, you're supposed to infiltrate that into the site. And so if you have something like a well on the site, or it's a hot spot land use where there's a lot of pollution, it's not suggested to infiltrate. But you could, put contamination into the ground, and so we have an exception for that, where instead of infiltrating the full water quality volume, you can infiltrate the amount extent practicable, and design the site to remove 80% of the total suspended solids. And that is also related to, again, that the first flush event. So when you treat the full water quality volume of 1.25 inches, studies have shown that it results in 80% removal of suspended solids from runoff. And so we wanted to keep that in there. And then the recharge volume that you would be asked to the maximum extent practical to continue to infiltrate would just be to maintain existing groundwater recharge rates. If, again, if there's a possibility of groundwater contamination, we wanted to put this exception here so that you didn't do that. You didn't have to do that. And then we have an exception for the overbank and extreme flooding criteria, so that's maintaining the pre-settlement peak discharge rate. In the case that you do a downstream hydrologic assessment, and I'll talk about what that is briefly, and you find that there's no increase in the total peak discharge from your site, or there's actually an increase because of the structural controls you were going to use for stormwater, those requirements are waived. And so a downstream hydrologic analysis, it's basically, you look at the outlet of the area downstream, and you determine, so there's a rule called the 10% rule, and so above it, an area of influence of 10% of your site, when your site has above an area, an influence on the total drainage area above 10%, then it's not, you only have to do a hydrologic assessment to the point at which your system is greater than or equal to 10% of the total drainage area. So that's the point of influence of the site on the drainage area. And if you find, though, that because you're controlling for peak flow, there's a longer duration of that greater volume of runoff increasing into downstream tributaries because you're holding a really big volume and releasing it so slowly that things are compounded in the watershed, you don't have to do the structural control. Does that make sense? You want negative consequences of large-scale practices. And that's something that's outlined how to deal with stormwater management and all that, but we wanted to codify it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then finally, we have credit. So when you're using low-impact development practices to protect resources, minimize soil compaction, restore soil and native vegetation, you can get credit. And so, for instance, if you don't disturb natural areas, you can subtract the area of that natural area that's not disturbed from the area you're managing. If you're able, through low-impact development practices, such as preserving natural area, to control for the channel protection volume, to treat all that volume on site, and you don't need to do extended 24-hour detention, then you can just, deduct anything and infiltrate on site from that total volume that you have to detain, or if you infiltrate them, you don't have to do detention for the channel protection volume. These next credits are related to that peak discharge rate. So the peak discharge rate is based in part on an index called a curve number that shows the ability of soil to retain runoff. And so your curve number, there's a scale of curve numbers, and it's an index that sets from 0 to 100. And so you can decrease your curve number if you do the following practices, because they will essentially help you retain more water on site. And so by decreasing the curve number, what you're doing is getting closer to that green settlement curve number that you're trying to. So you can decrease the curve number if you, don't disturb the soil or complete soil restoration so that soil is healthy and can infiltrate water. Additionally, you can reduce the curve number for an area of 800 square feet per tree that's protected. You can meet criteria for significant trees that are ornamented. It can't be, living invasive species that are dying. You can be prepared for it. And then you can also reduce the curve number if you replant native vegetation. And so that's for a tree, and you can reduce the curve number if it's an area of 200 square feet per tree or 25 square feet per shrub. Do you guys have any questions?
There's a lot. I'd like to make a point, if I may. This is going to add thousands and thousands of dollars to the cost of building. And I'm not saying this is a bad thing. But we've had something like this. Let's don't have the county ever say again that we need affordable housing. Because this, here again, is going to really increase the cost. But let's just want to make this clear. I think it's an excellent point, especially you bring up the subject of affordable housing. And I'm wondering if there's a way that at least, I don't know what the fees are going to be for this, but at least to waive the fees for affordable housing projects as a...
Mm-hmm. So
I've seen that done in other areas too. And
I guess we in Surrey County don't really have a multi-family zoning district, first off. But also our fees, and it's something we can certainly consider, but they're not terrible. They're about $175 for a subdivision. And zoning permit is based on 0.15% of the cost of the dwelling. So a dwelling zoning permit might be, like $200 to $400.
Your cost is going to be in engineering, so
yes.
You have to have your fees, I understand that. Contractors now have to hire an engineering firm to set this all up, or you still set it all up. So, I know I'm not going to get stopped, but I just want to make a point that every time we add an ordinance or change the code, it adds the cost of building. Okay? If we say, okay, that's fine, we're just going to do that, then let's don't talk about affordable housing, because it's impossible to build affordable housing in this county with all the regulations and codes we have and the cost of land. Okay? We'll keep what our government calls affordable housing is not affordable housing. It's subsidized housing. That's where you take money out of my bill hold and give it to that person to build a house. I'm not saying we shouldn't do that, but don't call it affordable housing. It's not. It's subsidized housing. I just want to get that off my chest. Not that I'm against this, in fact, this is a bad thing. It just keeps adding cost and cost to buildings.
Right, that whole discussion about affordable housing and we have low density for the most part, but that's not to say that in the future we may be amending the ordinance to allow room flexibility for more density in certain locations in corporate areas.
Most of the affordable housing discussions are taking place in urban areas.
And right, so because we don't have access to the county to amenities that are required to make that work too, which is public transportation.
It always amazes me that every time to people in the trades about how to build affordable housing, they have commissioned people who have no clue how to build that or what the cost is.
Well, I don't think when we talk about affordable housing, when we're talking about multifamily units, either the affordable housing can, you know, for instance, Habitat for Humanity build houses that are single family homes that turn out to be affordable housing.
And I would add, though, if it's a single family dwelling and they're not disturbing more than an acre, this doesn't apply. So for like one single family dwelling, if they're doing a good job, an orderly job of construction on the site, none of the stormwater applies.
I didn't mean to give this discussion for a while, I'm sorry.
No.
So that's a good point. But that's only one. If you're doing a subdivision, it's going to be more than an acre, it applies.
Yeah, yeah.
So how many times have we ever seen anybody try to build one home as a square mile?
I don't ever see anybody in the country build a house on one acre.
We just finished a giant project. Not to get too far in the weeds about this board. That phrase does not exist in America. We just did a thing with an architect, a developer, and engineering group of names in the old middle school site, which has been somewhat controversial. And we went to several industry big dogs and said, what's the most efficient way to build a home that is low energy use, so long-term cost of ownership? By the time we were done and made some money on it, I think it was a 12.5% margin. That home was $309,000 to sell, and that included a 3% realtor commission. It just doesn't exist. The cost of new materials, we've gotten so far away from affordability. I'm editorializing, but I don't think single-family affordable housing exists in the United States at all, unless there's a massive subsidy.
I just want to add that one of the comments we received from someone before was that those peak discharge controls for the extreme storms, like 100-year storms, it was really expensive. You know, the water quality volume and the channel protection volume are less expensive. And so we did introduce that kind of step threshold. So over 5 acres now you have to do that extreme and over mice flooding protection and controlling the peak discharge rate. But under 5, you don't have to do that.
And that's over 5 acres of disturbed area.
Yes.
I have a 5-acre lot that I'm building a house.
Right.
That's from disturbance. Mm-hmm. Access drive, footprint of the single-family dwelling.
So, my question, I guess my comment on this is, this is a lot for us to take in and figure out, right? And really did a great job in, you know, walking through it. What's the target audience for this, though, and is it going to be understandable enough? You know, I looked at the PDF, and, you know, it was a lot of red, right? I mean, it's all new. I guess my question is, the intended audience is anybody in the county. That how is this requirement put before them in a way that people know it's there, people know how to comply with it, and are able to, right?
So I think, you know, after this, we're going to take it back to the stakeholder community. So we did this before when we rather the organizations for comments and feedback from a lot of the main developers, as well as environmental groups. So for stormwater, I think that does apply to our larger developments. And the standards themselves are geared towards, you know, an engineer or other
designer. Right. So you're kind of target audience for this is any of the engineering firms that are doing it.
Yeah, I think erosion control is a little different, though, because that's geared to most folks that are doing a project.
We want anybody homeowners to understand.
Yeah.
To do the installation.
Yeah, and so the good news is that when folks come in for a zoning permit to apply, we can point this out to them and say, hey, we've got these standards, so you need to apply your property, point in the direction of the manual. I think we're going to do some few other outreach.
When you say a manual, do you mean the low impact development manual for the stormwater states?
For erosion control, statewide urban design guidelines. For stormwater control, usually the stormwater management manual.
And then we can talk about low impact for development and this. Is there a manual for that?
So there is a chapter in the stormwater management manual on that and some of the practices.
Yeah.
Our model or the ordinance that you have tonight is based a lot on emissions low impact design manual.
Yeah. Yeah, but I'm just wondering how people reference that and what they see in the manual.
The manual?
They have low impact.
So I guess when people reference it, it would be an Iowa stormwater management manual. And it's a chapter on how to do the calculations for a site where you're using and preserving natural areas. There's also chapters on natural vegetation restoration. And actually, there is a state one for Iowa.
But it is in the stormwater manual.
There's a chapter, but it's not full robust.
I'm just wondering, when someone uses the DMP, that's management practice, and you guys are giving credits for it, or they're doing that calculation. If there's an official list.
There's an official manual of calculation for all that. That I was not on the measure. Is that it? Yes. Answer? Okay. No problem. And then we can also do these worksheets that are really nice to do that you fill out. And you have available what is the total disturbance area percentage for impervious cover, different land uses to calculate.
The availability of what you're paying on the site. Into that something we're going to work on. Plan to be having that available. Getting to your question about education or learning part of NI, personal requirement is employees to do more outreach. And I have put together a plan by June of this year, and it would include, if and when this ordinance is adopted, we would reach out to real estate representatives, developers, builders, and go out to the association meetings and talk about the requirements. And, we understand that it's one thing to work on these ordinances and work toward their passage and approval, but we also have a role and responsibility to educate the general public too and to get them to understand the details of it. So that's going to be part of our mission too that we're going to work on.
Yeah, because I think my concern is there's a significant change, right, in what the county is putting into the ordinance. And Amelia spent, I'm sure, significant time summarizing it in a way that she can explain it to us. And Jerry's concern is real about this is a lot of stuff, and it's going to require professional intervention, interpretation, involvement, and I want to make sure that we're not putting something out there that's so detailed or so complicated that it's causing an unreasonable burden.
Right. She has done a lot of work on this and is taking this on as a project leader on it, and I think we're at a point where we've really condensed it down to the most important component parts. And these are not things that are going to be unique to Story County. These are regional in nature, and we've looked at ordinances from other counties in Iowa and in other states. So we're drawing on.
I'm on board. One of the first one of the first things that we dealt with on my, when I began my term 5+ years ago, was the development of off cameras for the road, and it has, despite engineering assurances, it did not meet their commitment and their expectations about how the water runoff and what would happen. So I'm on board with trying to ensure, you know, in the CCC, that was one of the highest rated concerns, was water quality and stormwater management and things like that. So I'm on board with doing it. I just want to make sure that we're not, I don't want to say overdoing it, but I want to make sure that we're striking the right balance with making sure that we have controls in place and things that we can enforce against things that are so difficult to understand that they're not, that they're not, you can't comply.
And I think, you know, we're going to do the grounding of this again, developers and engineers and that kind of thing.
And get some
comments. Yeah, absolutely. You know, we have a list, I think it's got 30 folks along that we've been emailing it to.
Then I like this as, could we see it referenced? Can we see a copy of that?
Sure. I don't have it right now, but yeah. And do we write it to again? You know, before we do the press release, I think, and I'm on the page of my radio show.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Right. If you guys have suggestions on other organizations,
yeah,
you could send this to get input.
And talk to you.
And talk to you.
Wouldn't it be possible, instead of force feeding all these requirements, couldn't we give the standards, put the onus on the engineering firms, you know, to put more insight that the property we're talking about, I think we're all familiar with this, that my understanding is that's the engineering firm. I think I'm familiar enough with it that I'm confident saying somebody dropped the ball there, somebody that should have their own emissions insurance. You know, wouldn't it be possible to just say, here's what our standard is, you guys figure out how you're going to do soil compaction, et cetera. And if they fail, we have an enforcement mechanism in place. But then it doesn't really increase the costs. It's, you know, it's up to them to achieve that level. But we've got to have an enforcement mechanism that has teeth in
it. And we reference a lot of, you know, third-party standards, right? Referencing the low-impact development, referencing do we need to itemize what our specific requirements out of them
are? So I think the main requirements are
but we're putting some specifics in in our ordinance that
so
these other organizations that we're using as a reference
when you're designing your practices, you have to design it to those three main criteria, those numeric criteria. Managing the water quality volume of a rainfall depth of 1.25 inches, providing 24-hour extended detention for the 1-year 24-hour storm, and making sure there's no peak discharge rate increase from the pre-settlement discharge rate for all storms up to the 100-year 24-hour storm. And that's what you have
to do. These are the main components of the stormwater reception.
There's a lot of flexibility on how they can get.
You know, we're not really that.
Right, just what the requirements are. So,
you're
looking for, this is just a discussion, there's not anything would we like to entertain any motion as any kind of recommendation or feedback for this? Or
anything that we're missing, anything that you see as necessary to, for us to consider to add?
I would go back to the affordable housing issue. And I don't know if there's anything that can be done, but let's at least look at how it's been addressed in other places. And if there are any bonuses or banks to credits that could incentive.
And I wouldn't even look at it from an affordable housing perspective so much as an engineering burden, right? Because that's what it comes down to, I think, in Jerry's issue is a cost of compliance, right? Having to bring in an engineering firm to design a solution because of the requirements. And I would just look at that. I'm not saying that it's right, wrong, or indifferent. It's just something that I think if the concern is compliance cost because of engineering external third parties that are required to get paid. I look at the IRS and say, if you have to hire somebody to figure out how to get your money back that you've already given to the government, then that's a problem.
And we'll make sure to rather
than anything. Do we have a motion to or a recommendation for this recommendation?
What is the discussion item? So okay, we're just looking for any input.
So we don't need a motion, but I think my feedback, my direct feedback to you is this is good. I think it's important. I think it's what we want to do based on the priorities of water of water issues that we have in the county. And I also like the approach of continuing to take this back to private sector third parties to get feedback and input.
We'll ask Stephanie to help us with that list about that, commissioners. And again, if there's any other groups that you think that she could provide to us.
Her
reverse
mind.
Yeah, so we'll get that list and then.
Just. Yeah, you did a good job. It's creating a lot of work.
Okay.
A huge project. She's done a great job.
Yep. I recognized that when I was looking at that draft of the next PDF and saw the amount of red. The whole thing was good. All right. Moving on to agenda item 6.2. Discussion of report on comprehensive.
You don't have to log out here if you're going to the G drive.
Yourself appropriately to the microphone. Yeah, that's why I left. All right, well, this is the land evaluation site. We have been before the Planning and Zoning Commission a couple times to talk about our current land evaluation site assessment system that we use. The current system, believe it or not, has been in effect since 1986, so we're running on 33 years of operating under this process. Again, the primary purpose of those land evaluation site assessment is to determine and preserve highly suitable agricultural properties. So if they're considered highly suited for agricultural use, the goal is to keep it in agricultural production. So the ways that we actually measure it are, there's three approaches. One is through the property research applications that we request. Property owners are people who are interested in acquiring properties in the county can submit an application. We do require a $30 fee, and we use our GIS system to go through the process to make that determination as to whether or not it needs the land evaluation site assessment. If it has a high score, usually above 267 or higher, that means that it's highly productive and should stay in agricultural use. So property research is the primary way that we're using land evaluation site assessment. We also have a need to use the lease assistant for certain conditional use permit requests, a separate process that involves the Planning and Zoning Commission, ultimately the Board of Adjustment. It's an application that demands a separate review, also involves other county departments. Usually it's a request to use a property that has a greater impact on the property, on the neighborhood, with regard to traffic, noise, things like that. So if we do the land evaluation site assessment and the score is between 267 to 300, which is the max, then again, that use cannot go on that parcel because the unit's deemed to be the productive farm ground. The last area where it comes up in the ordinance is if the property is zoned A1 agricultural district or A2 agro business district, and there's a request to change the zoning from A1 or A2 to something else, and the land evaluation site assessment score is between 267 or 300, it says it cannot be rezoned. So again, the goal is to protect farm ground, and that theme is prevalent in our C2C conflict. So again, as I mentioned, we were before the Planning and Zoning Commission a couple of times, one in August and the second time was in September. The first time was when Ryan, our planning intern, was working during the summer. We reported that there's six counties that have a land evaluation site assessment. There's 99 counties, so a small percentage of the counties have a land evaluation site assessment program. Of those that we communicated with, Blackhawk County and Lynn County provided the most information to us. The general background information that was consistent with those two counties is that those counties do not make the score information available online. They do provide it to the applicants or to the general to the property owners. The scores are actually tabulated and calculated in-house by the staff. We use the GIS system to do part of the data that we're working on. And then they also provide a lot of information about their program and how they determine how the scores are tabulated. They provide that information on site, so those were consistent. And then in September of last year, we talked a little bit about our approach and the form that we use. It's actually a two-tiered step. One includes the site evaluation, which really gets to the soil's quality, as well as trying to measure how that parcel fits in the neighborhood and its proximity to like an urban area or a municipality. So the combination of the site assessment and the questions that we ask in making that determination are figured into what that total lease score is. And then we also went through an actual property research request that we had. Throughout this review, there's been comments provided by some of the commissioners about trying to streamline the process that we have, maybe perhaps trying to use Beacon. The county's website
you know, if there was an option of having property owners or people who are interested in acquiring properties, maybe click on a parcel to try to get to that information, which is possible to do that, but it's important to note that when one parcel changes, it has impacts on other properties, and the scores are never static. It's always changing. So that's something that would need to be built into this. So we spent some time reviewing our current system, our current form. We also pulled some information from 1985. There were some staff reports. We provided a copy of that on the website for the commission to take a look at. So you kind of see the background of the analysis that was done to put together the system that we have. And I was just reading some information the other day that they actually started this 3 years before it was actually implemented in 1986, and just to understand it and to study it. So before this LISA system, we were using the court suitability rating system. We learned from 1986 that they used a random sampling of 96 parcels. There were a total of over 9,800 agricultural parcels that were reviewed, but instead of looking at every one, they did a random sampling of 96 of those to get a handle on the effectiveness of this program. So some of the conclusions of doing this review and the information that we've collected so far is that we think the system that we have in place is effective in evaluating the productivity of soil and the agricultural value for continued ag use. We think that, again, the system as intended has been viable in identifying and preserving ag properties, primarily through the systems that we use in evaluating requests for conditional use permits and rezoning applications. Current approach and questions are reasonable and provide an adequate way to evaluate current and future ag use of the property. And again, there's all kinds of information of how they actually got to the questions that they got to. It was quite an extensive process. And again, they believe that they hit on the questions. It actually measures whether or not it's in a rural area versus more of an urban area. The closer you get to a urban area or a city, the scores typically drop. So they felt that it was statistically relevant. Again, the approach can be changed. It could be automated, but it's likely going to require a consultant or somebody to do a GIS modeling, which would require more staff time and commitment to maintain that. The thing that we like about the current approach, though, is really highlighted in 5 and 6, because it allows for an opportunity for property owners and people who are interested in acquiring properties to come to us, to start a dialogue about what they're proposing to do before they actually go out and hire a land surveyor, do the division, have them work on development plans. And if that happens, the latter happens, and those are difficult situations, but they're real situations for us to have to deal with after the fact. So we like the fact that we're a partner through this land evaluation site assessment process that we have. It encourages property owners to submit the application and start this dialogue with us so that we can kind of communicate with them about what the county requirements are. We think that we need to add some definitions to help provide that clarity and consistency, so no matter who's doing the review, we're going to be able to hit on versus like what's an agricultural property. Sometimes it's not real clear looking at the aerials if there's no row crops, and maybe the number of acres. Is it prairie? Is it possible that, because we're not only just looking at row crop or growing, we're looking at livestock production. Can you graze sheep, cattle on the property, so we have to consider that as well. And some of the early notes reference obtaining water and sewer line information, which would get to the accuracy of the reviews that we're doing, as well as where the fertilizer sales locations are, because those probably change annually. So recommendation, we think we have a system that is pretty strong, and we would like to continue to use it. We think there's some modifications that need to occur. The actual form that we use, and I did scan that if you want to go through any of that, there's reference that was made to the previous comprehensive plan. We've actually already worked on updating it so that it's more relevant to the current C2C plan. We want to get mapping information, if we can, from cities on whether existing sewer and water line is, as well as fertilizer sales locations. Again, definitions need to be added for ag, land, fertilizer depot, define public transit and what a built-up area is. Just as we were working on it as a staff, I had a different view of what a built-up area was than what was really intended, which is really they're really referring to incorporated cities. So that we think that needs to be defined so that, going forward, everybody is using the same information. And we think we need to place the form that we use on the county's website so that property owners and people who are interested in properties will know, what's being, what the questions are and how the system works. And then, of course, continue to monitor the proposed changes. And I just threw in here just the property research. This is since I started in 2015. We had like 11 applications. That grew to 30. 2017, we had 49. 2018, 46. And so far this year, we've already had two requests for property.
This is why we just got the same thing.
What's that?
This is why initially,
they both do these. They're very efficient.
And so, can you get the cross reference?
And you know, like I said, I get a copy of the form, and we'll be happy to go through that. Would you have any questions?
Sure, I do. I'm all for federal government, I think I thought when I read before I came over tonight, I read something about public transportation was the criteria that you used. Emergency response, have you got that in there? You take that out.
Yeah, just the availability of municipal public transit. And in most cases, in most areas in the county, isn't that usually a pretty high?
So the only instance which you would get any points taken off of that is just north of Ames, very close to the boundary, north of Ames, and then along South Ames.
Why do we care about public transportation? If I want to build a house in the middle of 500 acres, nothing around for 500 miles, why should you care?
Right. Well, the goal is to try to figure out, whether or not that land should stay, whether or not it's highly productive, or maybe it's in a transitioning area.
I can understand that part. I can understand.
And yeah. Some areas are.
So you didn't at one time you had emergency services and how close to our service roads? Did you have that in there?
No. And again, this is the first page. So you're looking at the first part is the average site assessment, which really gets to what the soil qualities are, the soil characteristics, and then break it down into these 10 questions. The first one's the percent of area in ag within 1 mile. And we use the GIS system to calculate that. Land and agriculture adjacent to the site, and there's different ways that that's measured.
How about the municipal water system? Why do you care?
Because the idea is if the closer you are to a city, then you're probably in more of an urban setting than a rural setting. And the goal, again, is to protect those areas that are highly productive.
If you had this in place in the late 1800s and early 1900s, it would be farmhouses.
Yeah, so again, like,
but it's different if you're trying to build a farmhouse on 40 acres, and it doesn't even apply.
Right. Well,
or does it?
Well, it's a 35 acre in the A1 district, there's a 35 acre minimum lot.
What?
If
you
want to
build a house on 100 acres?
This doesn't apply.
Yes, it does.
Not on A1. No, this is used for rezoning and for development.
Conditional use only requires.
So there's an acreage break off here somewhere. If it's less than or more than 10, you don't worry about all this.
Yeah, and usually where it comes up is in the A1 district. Much of the land in the county is A1 agriculturally zoned.
Which I understand.
So if it's about housing, you know, there's a 35 acre minimum lot size, but then our zoning ordinance allows for exceptions. If the parcel is less than 35, is a legal non-conforming lot of record. So in other words, if we pass an ordinance that made that parcel non-conforming, if we did, then you can build on it. If it is a farmstead, you just divide off of 1 acre in the farmstead. Or if it meets the land evaluation site assessment score, then you could do a 1 acre division of that parcel and build a house.
I think that land assessment is a good idea.
Right, and then in 2012, I think it was, the board adopted a policy for allowing property owners where they have an existing dwelling to do another division for a lot to build another house, and that's the residential parcel subdivision.
So this is really, we had that application that came up in December or January. And there was the floodplain, it backed up to a floodplain, and there was another development on the other side of the floodplain. And most of it was hilly and used for livestock or less natural, but there was some very high scoring portion of the land that was in row crops, and it ended up being like, I don't remember, 266 or something very close, and it ended up going down, but that's kind of the use, the intended use for it is where we're going to take farmland out of production and develop it. Is that, should that land be protected as agricultural land or not?
That's it. You kind of see here, like, distance to municipal boundary. The closer you are to a city, then, you know, you could get less points. So the further you're away, you're going to get more points. And if you have a lot of points, then that means that it's not a rural area.
It should be preserved. Is there any discussion that I think is there more that you have more?
That's pretty much it. I have the form. Again, it's just a discussion item. Part of it is a work program item. We are supposed to look at the current system that we have. We are not proposing any major changes. And again, we really like the fact that this process that we have in place, it encourages people to communicate with us. And we have a concern that if it could be automated, besides the staff involvement, because this can take some daily to manage a system. We don't want there to be, you know, to lead to miscommunication. We want them to think that they can do some things maybe that they can't. And it's an avenue for them to come in and start that dialogue and have a discussion with us. And in turn, I think we check out really good, thorough report that provides options.
And we can do those tonight.
And that's, you know, that's, I think that's very important. That's right. And we want to keep monitoring.
Is this now in your code? Is this a county code now?
We've got definitions of what the land evaluation site assessment is. We have reference to it in certain chapters. So,
so it is mandatory.
For certain things, like Marvin mentioned, like for certain requests to do a conditional use permit, you have to have a low land evaluation size assessment for here in A1 or A2. We have to run those numbers to see if it can be rezoned. Because again, the goal is to protect and preserve and keep farm ground, farm ground.
So I like the form. I like having the form there. I think, automating it, if that was like a one-time solution, then I would like that. Knowing that this uses lots of different moving parts, it is going to take administrative overhead to keep it. It's only going to be semi-automated, right? And I like the interaction that you get from it. What I would encourage is, I'm a big fan of transparency and of understanding how we get from, for lack of a better term, how the sausage is made, right? Mm-hmm. So in this case, how do we get that number? And there's the form, and it gives the point values and things. What I would say is, for each one of those, 10 or 11 steps, just a link that describes, how do you figure out the value for one of these, right? So step one is you do this. Step two is you derive, point value one. How do you do that, right? And I would just put that up on the webpage. So if somebody's interested, if they're just curious, that they could make not maybe an exact assessment, but they could follow the steps and get to a reasonable estimate,
right,
of what their value would be.
Right. We don't want it to be a mystery for people. We want them to understand how we're,
automating it. Again, automating it would be great if it was as easy as going to Beacon, clicking on the lot, and seeing the leases for it. But knowing that there's, 11 components that make up an individual lot score, automating that would just be.
You probably have to have some kind of disclaimer on the data to do anything. Just make up the estimate.
Exactly.
So the value of automating it might not get you where you would be.
Jerry, I have a question. Just on this water main, does that include low water main as well?
I think it's just primary cities, like distance from wherever this parcel is that we're evaluating to the city's water main.
I totally disagree with that again. It shouldn't be our business how far they are from municipal water. Who cares?
I don't think that should be a criteria in deciding whether we can build it.
It's just a measure of
it's one of the
proximity to a city.
But, okay, then let's say that. Let's go put it in water.
Well, there's, I think, three different measures that measure proximity to the city, right?
Yeah.
Like just the water, sanitary sewer.
There's public transportation,
right? Like half mile to within a little more than 150 feet. But again, usually if, the closer you are to an incorporated area, the more urban the land uses become, usually. And again, when they did this, because a few of these questions, they're very similar, well, the same questions.
And these values, the calculating these values that give you that distance to municipality is trying to strike the balance between, yes, it's valuable farmland, but it's on the edge of the city. And so,
Right, and not in our comp plan, some of those areas are urban growth areas, which that brings up another component that we're going to work with those cities on plans. Is this an area that's planned for annexation? Should the city's development standards apply?
So what do you need from us in this as the outcome of this discussion?
Just whether or not you think we're on track. Again, we put together recommendations. Is there anything that you do you agree generally with the recommendation? Recommendation.
So we had the original request was to look at how we're using and what we're doing with these consumers, and there was a question about automation, and
it came out from the commissioners, from some of the commissioners that, you know, it would be nice to have something that's a little more accessible to the general public where, you know, they didn't have to go through more of a formal process. You know, to determine whether or not they can divide their property and, you know, maybe do a different use than what's maybe permitted.
Also, I think that's one too, if I remember right, to make the process a little more clear to the public as well.
Right.
And you think from what you've done here that you're able to do that better?
Yeah, and you know, we're not saying we're done with it. We'll continue to monitor these changes that we're going to make and you know, go from there.
So, this is a work item, right? This was on your work list, I guess. So, are you looking to say, There's not a proposal to say let's stop using this. There's not a proposal to say let's automate it. What are you looking for from the commission out of this? I mean, when do you consider this work item complete?
Well, I think if you support this, we would go to the board with the
recommendation,
planning design commission recommendation. Again, this is a discussion item, so this would be back before you, I think, in March. But really, the task was to look at the existing system and see if any changes are necessary.
I think one thing would be to make a web page on the county website. You know, putting your definitions up there, putting the documents up there, the worksheets, and to make that transparent, right? So do we have a motion to clarify what we're asking the staff to do?
Yes,
I'm asking,
what we have is what we're recommending to do, and so you could although this is just a discussion, so I probably need to bring this back, but you can consider these, you know, recommendations.
I'm going to do accept your recommendations. I think
and then just bring me back.
Bring back in March. This whole thing is going to be a big problem. I think we can simplify the forms online. I agree with you. Dealing with can automate it. The cost of the astronomical. Somebody wants to do the county. And but the only thing I would add is to say that at least a score, if there's a request made by a landowner or even a prospective landowner for at least a score, that should be posted. It's public information, right? You spent taxpayer dollars to develop that. I think it should be put up there. It also gives people an idea about how that process works. So I am a believer in 110% transparency. So if somebody wants to have the county spend money to get leases for, they should be posted somewhere. There can be a simple page that says lease scans. It doesn't have to be elaborate.
No, just the total numbers.
Any work product you're going to put together, there's got to be an application form.
So if someone requests a lease score on some property we've already done, we provide that to them. I guess my hesitancy about
actually uploading a property research report to the web page is that, again, those reports change with annexation, things change with subdivision, things change.
Somebody sends in a freedom of information request. They're going to get it. And it should be posted. The internet is a disservice to the taxpayers to force them to jump through a bunch of hoops to get something that they're going to get at the end of the day, no matter what. So if it's available under a FOIA request, it should be posted on the website.
Well, with the FOIA request, there can be charges that are applied to gathering that information. So like the staff had to go to work to get that, and they can charge a fee. It's not necessary.
So we have a motion. We have a motion following the recommendation with the addition of suggestion of making Lisa's course or what product available on the web. Do we have a second? So there is no second. So the motion fails. Do we have any additional motions as a recommendation for staff related to this work?
I would make a motion to call staff recommendations, but add a number 8 item that would include some kind of transparency for the Lisa process, putting any documents that would be needed to complete it, forms, blank forms, online, and some kind of detailed explanation about the process available on the website.
Second. Okay, so we have a motion by Sherwood and second by Moore. Do we need any discussion about the motion? Okay, no discussion. Can we have a roll call vote, please? Yes.
Moore?
Yes.
Cable?
No.
Sherwood?
Yes. The motion carries for following the recommendations and adding the additional requirement for additional documentation forms and instructions for transparency.
Yeah, and I just want to add, too, that when we, you know, when we start reviewing properties, if you know, we look at our historical records and if there's been a previous lease done, if it looks like the area has changed a lot, within close proximity, we'll run the numbers again. And oftentimes you get a different result because of this fact that these numbers are not static.
Thank you. Moving on to 6.3, discussion of draft natural resource area layer for Franklin Township.
Okay, so this is a work program I am as well, and it's to update our existing natural resource area layer that's a part of our future land use plan.
I just have to say these colors on the projector.
Really great.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, the very fact that there's more than 7.
So through this item was assigned in the C2C plan implementation matrix to both planning and development and conservation. So we had several lengthy discussions with conservation about what resources they have that we could use to get a more clear picture of what natural resources are on the site and map them. This is our existing natural resource layer. Don't mind the ink or the print. Everything outside of there, so everything with aerial image. This is the exact of the existing natural resource layer. As you can see, we kind of have this random squares in the middle of cornfields. And this is actually a pretty good area. But you can see that it's not as clear as it could be, not as consistent with real life as it could be.
So we spoke, we collaborated with conservation on this. We're looking, the proposed layer before you is a combination of the proposed FEMA flood maps that are anticipated to be adopted in 2020. The priority of restorable wetlands, which were from the watershed assessment recently done by the county. Both stream buffer recommendations, Amelia included those in her in the draft of the stormwater ordinance, and those are also included in what we would consider a natural resource area, trying to encourage development in those areas. Conservation had a survey priority site done, looking at the natural resources in the county and kind of prioritizing sites for actual on-site surveys. So those were included in it. We looked at aerial imagery, soil survey, and then the USGA topographic maps as well. So based on that, the proposed, here is in bright pink, we're expanding to encompass the entire FEMA floodplain. Obviously, that's a location where we would discourage development. We're adding the stream buffers, and then wetlands, looking at aerial imagery to make sure we're trying to preserve all the natural resources on the site. So there's not a ton of change here. I would say a majority of the change comes from actually including the whole floodplain area in the natural area designation.
Can you talk a little bit why you did that? Some of it's not natural resources. It could be even cropland.
Right. Yeah. We would, though, I mean, yes, I see what you're saying.
Just kind of gets to where you're supporting development and where we're discouraging development.
So, if it's designated as a natural area in the code, there's a couple different restrictions on development in those areas, and I think the floodplain, incorporating the floodplain is important for that reason. So, like in rezoning, if the parcel is over 50% natural area, it's required that we have conservation easement or a more restrictive zoning like residential conservation or greenbelt conservation rather than to like a residential use.
I didn't
yeah.
Kind of hear it.
No.
I'll just read it. Sometimes it's not always a natural
yeah.
resource area. It could be no crops or other could be prairie, it could be
the other thing that's worth and there's not many in the we are including what the watershed assessment designated as priority restorable wetlands.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what is 190? I can't quite read that. Is 190th Street there somewhere?
Yep, 190th Street
is. Okay, thank you.
So there's not any here, but these are areas that, yes, they have been converted to row crop and the wetlands have been taken out, but there are areas that the watershed assessment identifies as priorities for restoration. They're important to
so an example might be, it could be designated floodplain next to a creek that's currently in row crop, but we're going to discourage development and encourage restoring it as well.
That's correct. That's a possibility, yeah.
Could they copy the depth of the water table and soil data and where previous ones?
Yeah, we could, yeah. So we could go that far. We were attempting to strike a balance here.
what has been identified as priorities for restoration, what has been identified for future in on-site surveying. That's what we tried to kind of strike a balance. Because like you said, some of this is row crops. You're absolutely right. But we would discourage any housing development or commercial development in these areas.
Because of actual natural resource designation or including, but you're including in the sensitive areas or floodplains.
Right. But almost even you're heading for the potential for natural resources.
In some cases, we are. In some cases, we're just discouraging development within a certain boundary of a stream, just like because of the implications for erosion and for stormwater management. So this all kind of fits together.
This is a combination of resources, though, right? This is
correct. Because
conservation and water.
Mm-hmm. And part of the reason we were having so much trouble with these existing layers is that it wasn't clear what was used to tie them. We never really were able to figure that out. So
this is just what was previously done to me, but you don't necessarily know why.
Right.
So when you look at the attributes of your previous layer, there's no underlying information that you can draw. What about your new layer? There's no explanation. What about your new layer? Will you be able to see what type? Or will it just be a polygon?
That's a good question. I think primarily it will be a polygon. But we can have some information. We have to have some metadata in there to go in and.
Can you identify at least? I mean, you're using one color, right? You're using magenta to identify these are the natural resources.
For the purpose of this, yeah.
For the purpose of this. So, I maybe your question, I could be wrong, is can you at least identify? Here are the sources that we used, right? We used four different existing maps and or reports and or designations, and here's what they are to make up this. If you look at the prior and say, here's what was designated but we don't know why, can you at least with the new version say, here's what was used and here's why this is designated?
I see what you're saying, yeah. And that would be difficult for me to, I can attempt to do that for you.
Will this be on the Beacon website?
It is.
This would be a GIS, so it would be county.
It would be as a part of the future land use plan.
Okay.
For the future
season. Okay. For
the
county. So when you define that, like tell me how do you define it? Okay, like this layer, like for the public, how do you know?
Sure. What does this layer, if your property is designated, what does this mean?
What does it mean?
Sure.
Right.
So basically, development will be discouraged in this area. Unless there are additional measures taken to preserve the natural resources of the site. So principles in the C2C plan for this designation generally discourage development in unique circumstances where appropriate development types may enhance the area, recognize and encourage such approaches. Principle 2 is to mitigate impacts of proposed development contiguous to areas identified as natural resources. The third is to consider areas identified for inclusion in the Greenbelt Conservation District of the Land Development Regulations, or take necessary steps to ensure resource conservation. The board system develops site planning and performance standards to apply to properties designated as natural resource area, but not included in the Greenbelt Conservation District, to limit the impact of development.
I'm still curious about the methodology.
Okay.
Like, if you were to explain to the public the methodology to Jenny.
Right. Well, I took these layers, some of these layers. The first 1, 2, 3, 4 layers, and I literally merged them, and then looked at aerial imagery to encompass. For example, there are some lakes up in the northeastern area here that are not designated as floodplains and are not designated as priority areas for surveying on site, but we know that we would want to avoid these areas for development. Or if in the case that there is going to be development, additional measures should be taken to preserve the natural resource.
So I think maybe the short answer is these are the four layers that were used plus recognizable
area
imagery of natural resources.
Did you have your national wetland reserve?
What are the four layers then?
Four layers of a FEMA flood map that are proposed for 2020. The priority restorable wetland, so not areas
as identified by
a watershed assessment.
Okay.
Those stream buffers. As identified from the watershed assessment, which is a thing that Amelia had referenced in the stormwater management. And then Story County Conservation survey priority sites. Sites that natural resources have been identified on which they would like to do on-site surveying to see what's there.
So, do you think existing wetlands are covered in this?
I don't think we have a ton of existing wetlands.
But are they?
Much of it has been converted to row crops.
Where is, do you have another map that shows 35 in here? Because I know there's a designated wetland area right off of like 13th and
is it right on the north of 13th?
Just north of 13th on the east side of 35.
Or somebody use that.
I'm just as an example.
Yeah.
Right?
Somewhere outside of this area.
It is.
The outside
of the area.
Right,
this is
just
in Franklin Township. So,
okay.
Franklin Township.
Yeah, there's.
I can't get to our, so it's a little hard because I can't get to our BIS.
Yeah, right.
If it is identified again in the
watershed
assessment, it will be identified on the plan.
Countywide or just in Franklin Township?
Well, we're just taking one piece to talk about the methodology and then how we're communicating this information to you. So we're looking for feedback on how it could be more clear or a better way to show you the proposed layer.
And focus is the townships that have the most activity, the most change, growth.
So those are the ones we're going to do first.
I'm a little concerned about this 100-year, the flood layer being put on there. I think we can get that through different overlays and different mechanisms than in the natural resources. Like,
are you proposing to segregate?
Because we have
the floodplain maps from the designated natural resource area.
Yeah, I think we're talking about two different things.
Within the definition of a natural resource area in our code, and I think that's what Amelia is looking at, it includes floodplain.
Okay. So floodplain is a subset then of...
That's what you're looking at. And additionally, in the wetland methodology, the National Wetlands Inventory was used by the watershed assessment,
okay,
which we then used.
Okay. They gave you a layer of the whole county.
Mm-hmm. So they identified priority is over 5 acres, so there's other modified wetlands. So they really identified all modified drainage on wetlands. Former. Yeah.
Okay, so the request, right, what you're looking for to come out of this discussion is feedback on how this was done for these specific maps for Franklin Township before you move on to countywide.
Correct.
And update all the maps for seasons.
Correct.
Okay. So is there, based on, have you gotten through enough of your presentation to...
Go ahead.
is there significantly more different?
I show, I have the floodplain here, that's edited in blue, and then these are the areas for survey, survey priority sites.
On the Conservation Commission, they gave you a layer of that consultant.
Yeah.
I just worry that we're losing track of why these are designated.
Well, that is correct, and that was the idea behind why we wanted to update it, right?
So I believe, is there any specific feedback, suggestions, now that we've seen what they're doing and how they're doing based on the Franklin Township maps, is there feedback that we can offer on changes to what they're doing or how they're doing it?
I can maybe tell you what I'm hearing, and you can tell me if it's correct or not. I'm hearing that you would like to see all of the layers overlaid with some transparency.
I would appreciate seeing the parts that make up the whole. Right. And maybe not visually seeing them, but at least identifying, because I believe those other individual maps are also in the TQC.
The other individual maps are on the watershed, in the watershed assessment, and you can get to them on our website.
This is all electronic, all of these documents. Then it would be easy to say, here is the natural resource map in the TQC, which is made up of this component and a link, and this component and a link, and this component and a link, right? As of this date. Because those maps might change from the water system.
Yeah.
So
we did want to also include what we would consider natural resources that weren't a part of them. So based on like aerial imagery, what we can see as...
So some of them you could link to,
woodland,
and some of them you could just identify as
based on aerial
imagery in the second.
Wait, are you after like a link? You want to provide that?
No, I'm after transparency.
Sure.
I'm after understanding what parts make up the whole.
So if I provide a more detailed explanation to that, and then also provide some links within the references to the layer.
And I would say a summary, right, of
sure.
Definition of natural resource includes, you know, this natural resource designation includes floodplain, what are
yeah, and maybe if I would have printed off the memo hopefully, I mean, that would have been better for you. But, okay.
Where is the definition for natural resource? Where does it come from? Just our TQC?
Yeah.
does not, it's areas, it's not just like tree areas. It's areas that we would want additional preservation measures to take place to protect waterways, wooded areas. We would want to minimize as much development in those areas as possible. Not necessarily because what's the impact, in addition to what the impact would be on the site, but what the impact would be downstream. Does that make sense?
Is any of this designated an area where we're trying to maybe undo things that have been done?
Correct, yes.
We've run into several situations where we're looking at a rezoning request or a subdivision plat, and it's mapped a certain way, and then you look at aerial imagery or you walk the field, and it doesn't make sense. So we're trying to match up with real field conditions with the mapping, and that's been the goal.
And are you using the new flood layer?
Again.
Does this look like you guys are having hearing?
First day today. We had quite a few people come in. It was busy for 2 hours. And those are to be adopted fall of 2020.
That's the goal.
Okay. So do
I think I have enough direction.
Do you have enough direction? I mean, you're going to bring this back, right?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Any additional input before we move on? Okay. Then thank you for providing additional feedback, and thank you for the presentation. I know these discussions about work product are maybe different than what we normally speak. So
yeah.
Sorry for our.
No, we appreciate your input. It's helpful.
Yeah. Lack of structure in the discussion. Okay, so that concludes our discussion items. Are there any additional comments from staff?
The next meeting is March 6th, and again, you can expect everything that was before the Planning and Zoning Commission this evening to be back for that meeting for action. We'll have a vacation acquisition request, properties on 189th Street, northwest of Ames, will be before you. And also there's another work program item that we're working on with regard to smart development and trying to figure out if our regulations, we have smart development practices that limit disaster impact, so we're working on some information there to share with the commission. And the item that we had last time on the C&D sites, Doug provided some input on suggestion on contacting property owners that had the silver pile. And thank you very much. We did get some input from some of those landowners. They filled out the questionnaire. And so we provided them with a copy of our current lease agreement. And we're planning on following up with them probably next week, so we definitely appreciate that as an option. So we've got, I think we heard from at least 3 or 4 of those, so we're happy to do that. Every spring I stress that we don't have locations in case we get into that.
When you're entering the stress.
Yeah, right, it is. Well, I was telling one of these two that, well, we're almost toward the end of January, well, in February, so so that's all I have. Thank you again for your input.
Okay. Are there any commission comments?
Nice work, gentlemen.
Mm-hmm. Nice work. All right. Do we have a motion to adjourn?
Motion.
Motion made to adjourn. In a second.
A second.
All right. We are adjourned.